It's Something for Nothing, the Rush Fancast. Jerry and Steve with you. Jerry, how are you on week two of our fall season?
I'm doing very well, Steve. Thank you for asking.
You can find us on Twitter, Jer, or X, as they call it these days, at Rush Fancast. Instagram, find us at The Rush Cast. Also, Threads. Jerry's posting Threads daily.
Semi-daily. Semi-weekly, semi-monthly.
You can email us at therushcast@gmail.com. Complain about the lack of Threads. Find us anywhere you get your podcasts. And the base intro, of course, it's Lex.
Good old Lex.
Good old Lex. I hope you have an email to get us started, Jer.
I do. This is from Jason from Las Vegas.
Ooh, Jason from Vegas. Hey, Jason.
He sent this in August, so it's a relatively recent one.
Okay.
He says, I'm not sure if the inbox is still open, but I felt compelled to reach out just to express a big thanks for all the work that you and Steve have put into the podcast. I just discovered it a few weeks ago, and although I was sad to find that it was over, I totally understand. That had to have been a lot of work every week. Since I have no real friends that are into Rush, it has been a joy to be able to listen to the two of you hashing out all the fine details of this band we love. I especially appreciated the moments when we could hear in your voices the weight of emotion you would sometimes feel when reading Neil's lyrics. That's what they do to all of us sometimes, right? So great to hear it reflected in another fan. The episodes have rekindled my enjoyment of the music like a catalyst, I think, and for that, I am so grateful. Truly a big something for nothing. You guys deserve an award for this run of episodes. Hope all is well, and wish you all the best. Jason.
Wow, an award. That would be kind of cool.
Now, I know. They do have podcast awards. I'm not sure what they're called. The Potties, maybe? That's a terrible name.
That's a terrible name.
You never know. Maybe we'll be nominated one year for something.
Maybe one of our listeners will make a trophy and send it to us. That would be cool.
That would be really cool. Just a participation trophy.
I think we deserve an award, Jeff, for having this guest today, because this guest is incredible. Our guest this week is professor of drums at the Juilliard School in New York City. Drummer with Curtis Steigers and Vince Giordano's Nighthawks, contributing writer for Modern Drummer magazine. He's performed with Deborah Harry, Joe Williams, Elvis Costello, Wynton Marsalis, among many, many others. And he's also a huge, huge Rush fan. Dare I say, a Neil Peart historian? Paul Wells, welcome to the Rush Fancast. Is that accurate?
Thank you so much. I don't know if I want to take on that level of responsibility, but gosh, thank you. I mean, I do feel like there are some proper Neil Peart historians out there. Joe Bergamini, of course, comes to mind. If anyone doesn't know, Joe collaborated with Neil on the, Center Stage book.
Taking Center Stage.
Taking Center Stage, the book and DVD project, which is just a monumental feat of Neil Peart geekdom and educational information. So I don't know if I'd say, I mean, I do have, there are certain things, as you probably discovered if you listen to my podcast that I did, the three-part podcast I did on Drum History Podcast, I do have a knack for remembering minute details of Neil's drum sets. So I'll take credit for that. But other than that, I think there are other people that definitely went out on the historian claim.
Well, we like to start out, Paul, by asking our guests their Rush origin story. When did you first hear Rush, and how did you become a fan?
Honestly, it's a little bit vague because I remember being a kid, and my dad got MTV. My parents had split up, and I would visit my dad on weekends, and he got cable. And he got MTV around 1982 or 83, and I basically would spend my visits with him just watching MTV for 36 hours or whatever. Just the entire weekend. And I remember seeing Rush. It was probably the Subdivisions video. And then definitely I remember the Distant Early Warning video. And I just remember like this band, and there was this, they were kind of like, they looked like a rock band, but there was this guy and he had a whole lot of red drums. He had this gigantic red drum set. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I remember my very first drum lesson when my parents signed me up for drum lessons at a place called Swissvale Music Store in Pittsburgh. when I first signed up, they also bought me the latest issue of Modern Drummer magazine, which happened to be on the counter at the music store, just to kind of get me fired up about this. And it happened to be the April 1984 issue, which if I was better prepared, I would have that copy here. But it's Neil is on the cover. And the interview was done actually months before, November, I guess, or September 83, when they did the Radio City run. So it's photos from that. But again, it was like this cool looking guy. It's like, oh, there's this guy and he looks cool and he's got this gigantic drum set surrounding him. So I was sort of, I knew who he was, but I hadn't really listened to them. I hadn't discovered Rush as a band. And the real discovery was the summer between sixth grade and seventh grade. For the first time, my parents set me up to go to a jazz camp, to go to this music camp called the International Music Camp. It was in North Dakota. It was in the International Peace Gardens, which is borders the North Dakota and Manitoba border. There's this sort of park and camp, and they had a music camp in the summer, and it was Jazz Week. My parents are from Winnipeg, so we would go and visit our relatives there, and I would go to this camp. And this is the first year I went, and the drum teacher, we were basically studying jazz. And it was also my first exposure actually to jazz and jazz drumming and learning about that. But the drum teacher took us all, it was a beautiful day, and he took all of the drum students outside. We were normally inside in a classroom with a couple drum sets. He took us outside and he sat in the middle and we all sat sort of in a circle around him. And he had a boombox, like an old fashioned, you know, silver boombox. And he put in a tape and he played us the live version of YYZ from Exit Stage Left. And with Neil's still to me, I think his best recorded drum solo ever. It's just this unbelievably great solo. And I was completely blown away. It's this moment just changed my life forever. This was like not only my introduction to Rush and to Neil, who would be, you know, so pivotal and influential to me, but it was also like, I think that whole week was when I really discovered that like I was absolutely in love with the drum set and being a drummer and going in super deep on learning as much as I can about playing this instrument. And that was part of it, was hearing that solo. And then I remember on that trip after that week being so fired up and wanting to learn about drums and wanting to listen to drumming music. So I started buying records, you know, before I think I had like Purple Rain and I had maybe, you know, like a Duran Duran single or something like that. There were some tunes that I liked, but I remember having Weird Al Yankovic, Eat It, the Eat It single. You know, there are a couple of things like that. But I started like, oh, I gotta find records with like Buddy Rich and Max Roach and people like that that the drum teacher was talking about. But I also wanted to hear more of this guy. So I asked the next door neighbor when I got back home, happened to be a drummer, and he was more of like a classic rock, kind of an AC/DC kind of guy, Led Zeppelin. He was really into John Bonham. But he liked early Rush. And he was one of these guys who was like, I don't like the new stuff. It's all, you know, I don't like the synthesizers and stuff. But he happened to have All the World's a Stage. So he lent that to me. And I remember taping it, or at least I taped the drum solo. So I had that. And I started just like listening to it all the time. And it just went from there. And I just started, you know, one by one buying the records. I think Moving Pictures came next. And I got a proper copy of Exit Stage Left with the whole record. And September 87, I remember, so this was all like the summer of 86, I guess. And then about a year later, I remember Hold Your Fire came out. That was the new record. I remember buying that brand new. That was the first one I bought new. But I think by that point, I'd had most of the back catalog already by then. So kind of a long-winded origin story, but that's my that's my Rush background.
How did Neil go over with the jazz crowd?
You know, we weren't serious. We were all sort of like middle school and high school age. You know, we weren't like, I mean, this was actually, yeah, 86. I guess I was between sixth grade and seventh grade. So I was really young. I was 12 or 13. I mean, we weren't like dyed in the wool jazz musicians or anything like that. Yeah, we were just really getting started. And I think the teacher was great. I know the teacher was like a Buddy Rich guy. He was really into Buddy. And I think he just wanted to fire us up. He wanted to play us something like, he was like, oh, these young kids like this rock and roll stuff. You know, he was probably like just wanting to give us something we could relate to. And I remember everybody was like just in awe. Like everybody was kind of like, you know, laughing because it was just so amazing. There wasn't any sort of like, oh, this is jazz, this is, we shouldn't be listening to this rock stuff. There wasn't any of that at that camp. It was all just like, let's just play music, you know, whatever whatever you're into, just be into music and just be serious about studying it.
Have you found that later on, though? Because when I think of jazz drummers and jazz improvisation, I think, you know, a kind of looseness, a kind of grooviness. Neil doesn't really do that with his solos, right? They're very meticulous and very planned out. Is there a kind of a bias against that type of playing in different drumming communities?
You know, to be honest, most of the pushback that I've heard about Neil, or most of the criticism that I've heard about Neil, has been from fellow rock drummers and rock musicians who feel that he is either too busy, you know, he plays too much stuff, he's too active, and they want to hear somebody just playing a beat and nothing else. I mean, I know jazz musicians who just don't like anything except jazz. Like, they just don't have an ear at all for rock, and they would be negative about any, you know, whether it's like, you know, Ringo Starr or Metallica or, you know, anything, Michael Jackson, whatever, anything pop or rock, they just don't want to hear it and they can't relate to it at all. But most jazz musicians actually that I know are quite open-minded, and a lot of them are familiar with Rush. A lot of them, especially my age or a little older, may have grown up being influenced by Rush and music like that, prog music. Actually, a lot of jazz musicians nowadays that I know grew up with metal, and they were into the technicality of metal, and they wanted to kind of take it further and got into the, you know, learning about jazz, which is also very, very technical, or it can be anyway. Yeah, honestly, I feel like there's more criticism. I've heard more criticism leveled at Neil specifically, and Rush in general, and prog more generally, from more of a punk rock aesthetic or a sort of singer-songwriter aesthetic type of rock musician, believe it or not.
So after you heard Neil, Paul, you were all in on the drums, but what about your trajectory from there? Did you stick with the jazz, or did you veer to rock at that point because of Neil?
Well, so I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I was really lucky to be able to go to performing arts schools all the way from sixth grade through high school. So sixth grade all the way through graduating 12th grade, I was at in the performing arts middle school and high school. So I was surrounded by musicians as well as dancers, actors, visual artists, which was an amazing environment to be in, and really like a very profoundly lucky environment for kind of a nerdy kid to be in, because there wasn't the sort of like bullying, and I mean, there was a little bit of that, but not anywhere near what you stereotypically hear about with sort of normal middle school and high schools. So I grew up around musicians socially and was inspired by them. And I started playing professionally towards the end of high school, like around 11th grade, 12th grade. And then I took a year before I went to college. And my point about being in Pittsburgh was that through that entire time, all of the musicians that I knew that were serious musicians were into all kinds of music. And besides Neil, I was getting interested in other drummers like Bill Bruford, and then some of the fusion drummers like Steve Gadd, Billy Cobham, Dennis Chambers, Jack DeJohnette. These were all drummers that could play all kinds of music. And I became really interested in this idea of sort of the all-rounder slash studio musician who could just show up from day to day doing anything, you know, that they get called for. And believe it or not, there was opportunity to do that for me going all the way back to high school, because in high school, I was in the jazz band, which was sort of a big band. I was in the jazz quartet, which was a small band. I played for all of the musicals. So I was playing whatever. You know, one year we did Guys and Dolls, I think, or Anything Goes, like a traditional sort of like Tin Pan Alley musical. Another year we did Fame, which was a very sort of 70s, you know, like disco and soul kind of music. I was in rock bands through that time period. I remember doing some gigs with Afro-Cuban sort of Latin jazz bands. I mean, it's from an early stage, I had an opportunity to do all kinds of things. And I love that. And unfortunately, when you get to a big city like New York, you tend to get a little more typecast into a particular style. And, you know, that still affects me a bit now. But so I think I'm getting off of your question a little bit, but I think I'm kind of like just trying to, I guess, express that I've always been interested in a lot of different styles and was lucky to kind of be able to study them and indulge in them like from a pretty young age.
So when you think of the different eras of Rush, mm-hmm. 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, is there a certain era that you think the band is better. Do you know, not better, because I think all of this stuff is good, but progressed more than previous eras. Because in the 70s, you know, the first album notwithstanding, right, they had their thing. Mm-hmm. And then it seems like in the 80s, it was almost anything goes.
Well, I think there's a definite progression. It depends on how you define better, obviously, like better at what. I mean, there are probably still Rush fans that still feel that their first album is their pinnacle. And in some ways, if that's what you're into, if you're a Led Zeppelin and Bad Company fan, maybe that's the best Rush for you. You know, I know people that 2112 is what they think the best Rush album. Definitely if you talk to somebody like I know Mike Portnoy is on record as being like, you know, Hemispheres is kind of the pinnacle of Rush, and that La Via Strangiato is their hardest tune to play, you know, at least on drums. And I could see that. There is definitely something to that. Just from a technical point of view, that is a really fiercely difficult tune to play and requires a lot of endurance to be able to play. But if you're talking about other things like melodies, and I mean, I think Rush's melodies, their melodic writing, the vocal melodies, Geddy just got better and better and better and better and better with each album with that. And I feel like Signals is maybe one of the first records where I feel like he was maybe starting to really pay more attention to that and wanting to write melodies that were prettier and that had more of, I don't know, something with the phrasing where it was, maybe was working with Neil on making some of the lyrics a little easier to sing so that he could come up with more melodic phrases. And by Power Windows, Hold Your Fire, I mean, I think they're gorgeous vocal melodies on those records. And I think they progressed to the point where all the way into Clockwork Angels, I think some of their strongest vocal melodies are on that record. You know, like each record gets better and stronger with it in that way. I think that like The Wreckers is one of the most just gorgeous melodies, and the title tune Clockwork Angels as well. And I think also what Wish Them Well is an amazing melody. I mean, I think these are like, you know, there are definitely going to be Rush fans who think like, you know, oh, they peaked at whatever record. I think in a lot of ways they peaked it at Clockwork Angels. You know, it's not, maybe not always my favorite for certain things, but I think as far as songwriting and strictly melody writing, I'm not sure they did better than that record. I mean, I think there's amazingly beautiful things on that record.
I always say that Headlong Flight is like the perfect Rush song.
Mm-hmm.
It hits every kind of Rush note from the beginning of their career right to the end.
I agree. Yeah. I know they wouldn't ever do this, but it's almost like, let's write a tune for the fans. Let's write a tune that the fans want us to do. Because, yeah, there is a lot going on. And that's I've never tried to play that on drums, but I think that would be a really difficult tune, just endurance wise. It's a long tune and there's so much going on the drums in that tune. You know, I don't have a period other than just sentimentally, like, I mean, I have a very, very strong connection to Hold Your Fire, Presto, Roll the Bones, Counterparts, because of the time in my life when those albums came out and what I was doing and when I was listening to them, where I was when I was listening to them. I mean, I still remember places in my old neighborhood. I can see them right now, like walking down the street and listening with headphones and with my Walkman, listening to Roll the Bones and exactly where I was. And I remember like what the weather was like. I remember the girls that I liked and was trying to hit on it, and all of the stuff that is connected to that music and that time in my life. So I have a very strong connection to those four records in particular. I think that's always going to be something that I can't really talk without bias as far as judging those records, you know, but that's all part of it. We all have those kind of connections to music, you know, books and film certainly too, and maybe even food for some people. Like we have that, I mean, we'll be, you know, when we're very, very, very old, I think those are maybe going to be some of the things that we still remember, you know, and I think that's a great thing. I love that about sense memory and about how music does that to us.
We found talking to Rush fans that fans whose entry point were around the time of yours and ours, we came in around Power Windows, Hold Your Fire. Those fans seem to like Rush's whole catalog.
Mm.
The 70s Rush guys are the ones that came in the 70s. But if you came in the 80s, you love everything. That's what we've found, at least.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. And that may be true. I mean, I know I've met people who the first time they heard them was Snakes and Arrows or Clockwork Angels or something. I know a lot of people who never saw them until the aughts, you know, or even on the last tour or something like that. And I wonder what you guys maybe would know better. Like if somebody didn't discover them at all, whether they were like, you know, a teenager or whether they were just for whatever reason, they never listened to them, you know, and they discover them at that very late stage in their career. What's their perspective on Hemispheres or something like that? I don't know. What do you find? Have you met Rush fans who came to them that late?
It's usually the obviously younger fans that we talk to, and they also like everything. Because if you are starting to listen to Rush at Clockwork Angels, like you said, there's no bias between, you know, listening to Hemispheres for the first time and listening to Power Windows 10 years later or whatever and saying, well, it's a totally different band. For them, it's just everything is available to them at the same time and they appreciate all of it.
I met a drummer at a gig a couple weeks ago. His dad brought him there. He's like, you know, maybe like 14 or 15 and he's a drummer and he's really getting into it. You can tell he's got that fire. And he was talking about Neil. In fact, somebody introduced me because he met somebody else in the band. He said he liked Neil and he's like, oh, you got to talk to our drummer. And he couldn't believe that I saw, he was like, oh, and I told him, like, I started talking about seeing them in concert. He's like, oh my God, you saw them? You actually saw Neil in concerts? Like, yeah, I saw them like 33 times. And he was like, oh, I can't even. And I think it's so wonderful that there are people that are just getting introduced to them now. There'll be a point where there are people that weren't even alive when the band was active. You know, people born post 2015 that will become Rush fans. I mean, I see that in the jazz world because, you know, I mean, I'm lucky to have seen, you know, I was alive at the same time as Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie and some of the most important jazz musicians. But, you know, I wasn't alive when Duke Ellington was alive. I wasn't alive when Charlie Parker was alive or Louis Armstrong or so many of these. You know, there's now so many generations past the sort of like some of the most important artists, but their legacy is still as important as it ever was. And I think that Rush are going to be like that too for musicians and just fans of music.
Now, you're a professor at Juilliard, Paul. First of all, I think it's awesome that a professor at Juilliard loves Neil Peart the way you love him. But do you introduce your students to Rush the way you were introduced to Rush?
Well, it's funny because I haven't been there that long. I've been there 3 years, and Juilliard's jazz program is a very small and extremely competitive program. It's a ridiculously high level. It's basically, it parallels their classical music program and their drama program, where they're just world-renowned and extremely exclusive and extremely difficult to get into. I don't know what the acceptance rate is. I mean, it's something, you know, like 0.1% or something. So the students that I get are really, really advanced already. Even the ones that are just out of high school are really, really, really advanced. And they're already really serious about jazz. And we tend to dig in pretty much straight away on jazz music. And there's so much to cover. There's so much technique to cover. There's so many sort of like books of study and transcriptions of like repertoire and stuff like that that we have to deal with. That's like on the curriculum. So it's not going to be part of my curriculum, but it has come up because we also talk a lot. They are really advanced, but they haven't played a lot of gigs. They don't have a lot of experience. So a lot of the times things come up like, oh, I had this experience in this rehearsal. Could we talk about this? Or I was on this gig and this thing happened and I didn't know what to do, you know, when we talk about that. So things lead, or, you know, they move around and they may lead to other topics and, you know, we may talk about other kinds of music. But I actually have talked to a couple of students about Neil, because one thing that I think is applicable is Neil's approach to playing, sort of building a song and coming up with a part for one section of a tune, a different part for another section of a tune, like say a verse and a chorus. And then verse two comes around and he'll do the verse one part, but maybe a little more. or with a little different texture or something like that. And then Chorus 2 comes around and it's like Chorus 1, but up another level. And that sort of like, I don't want to say methodic, but just thoughtful approach to song structure and song sort of like the building and shading and coloring of a song, I think is very applicable to certain types of jazz playing, particularly large ensemble jazz playing. Talk about big band writing, where you're dealing with a lot of extensively written and sort of like, you know, pieces like that aren't particularly improvisational. They may have improvised sections, but with a lot of sort of written out sections too, and different sections of tunes that need to build and be shaded in different ways by the drummer. So it has actually come up and it is actually applicable. Like I'll say like, oh, you know how Neil plays on this tune, and they may know it or they may not. We may listen to it and we talk about how it applies. And this is the case with other rock drummers. I mean, Ringo does this with the Beatles, and you know, there are other examples besides Neil, but I do think that there is some crossover, and I will bring that in. I'm not afraid to, you know, there isn't, I was never told like, you can't talk about, you know, I mean, like I said, I'm given a curriculum of like, these are the things we expect a student to be able to do by the end of their freshman year. This is what they're expected to be able to do by their graduating year, et cetera. You know, so I do make sure that I try to cover all of those things, but there's a lot of leeway within that, I think, and time to kind of get creative. And also anything that gets people fired up about music, no matter what the style, whether it's Rush or if it's classical or something, if you're excited about music, then that's a good thing. You know, we want to keep them inspired and we want to keep them excited and we want them to be fans of music. I think some of my favorite musicians are fans of music. They're not just playing. They're not just players, and they're not just interested in playing, but they love music as a whole, and they're into just all kinds of music, and they want to be involved in music. So I think that's something important for any student at any level, to just kind of get them interested in music, whatever style it is. Just love it. Just love music, and that'll take you, you know, wherever you need to go.
Speaking of the way that Neil, you know, constructs his songs, what's your opinion on how Neil's solos changed when he moved the solo out of YYZ and into its own song, basically?
Yeah. You know, I like both approaches. So he played it for a long time in the 70s, kind of at the end of either Working Man or In the Mood, right? All the way through the end of the Permanent Waves tour. And it was kind of its own thing. Like, the tune sort of ended and then it went into something. It went into his solo, and his solo is like a separate thing. And I love that. I love those solos. YYZ, particularly on Exit Stage Left, which is, as we know, a document of the Moving Pictures tour. So the Signals tour also, same thing. It's in the middle of YYZ. And what I actually like about that, and this sort of applies a little bit to the jazz thing, I got to find a way to make this concise. So when jazz drummers play solos within a jazz tune, so I don't know how much you may know about this, but like, you know, jazz musicians are playing basically a tune that's like sort of a short form, and it may be a blues form, or it may be sort of like a AABA form. A lot of jazz tunes are based on I Got Rhythm, which is, it's a tune by the Gershwins. But those chord changes are really great chord changes to play on. And it's just 32 measures. It's basically just a short tune. And then those chord changes repeat, and jazz musicians play solos over those chord changes as long as they feel inspired. And when a drum solo starts in a jazz tune, the drummer is also playing over that same form. Now, drums are not a melodic instrument in the sense of like, you know, piano or horn. So we're not playing the notes of the chord changes, but we have the tune going in our head. That same form continues to repeat. And we as drummers are playing the tune. We're still playing that form, right? If it's AABA, we play something. And then for the B, for the bridge, we might play something different and then go back to the A. And that's kind of our basic framework. Now, the way this relates to Neil is that the YYZ solo, I always felt like he's still playing the tune. They play the tune and it's at a certain tempo. and it has a certain kind of rhythmic language. It's very 16th note oriented, right? So that, like Getty's bass line. There's a lot of that kind of, that kind of language. In jazz music, we refer to language being like, oh, this is the language of the style. Like it's sort of the type of rhythmic cadences and rhythmic ideas that we use. And when Neil starts his solo, he played that whole solo for the most part is in that same tempo and using that same sort of rhythmic language. It's sort of like the tune never stops. It's sort of like he keeps playing the tune. He's riffing and playing improvisations based on the rhythms of the tune, or at least the feeling of the tune. The YYZ solo in Exit Stage Left has such a fantastic energy from beginning to end. It's sort of relentless. And it's, I think, largely because he stays in that same tempo and just builds that tempo and then comes down a little bit to do the cowbell thing and then builds it back up and then comes down to do the gong bass drum thing. And only at the end, he kind of goes into a freeform thing for a little bit before he builds it back up to the fill that cues the band back in, right? He's playing YYZ the whole time. He never goes out of that feel. Does this, any of this make any sense?
Oh, yeah. How unusual is that, though, Paul, for a rock drummer?
That's hard to say, because a lot of rock drummers do kind of go into different things. They'll go into, like, play this thing for a while and then stop and then do something completely different. Like Neil's later solos when you know, like the Rhythm Method or something on A Show of Hands, and the solos he was doing later on where he would like, okay, there's this section and then it stops. And then here's something completely different, a whole new tempo, a whole new texture. And then, okay, that's done. Now we're going to spin the kit around and I'm going to play on the electronics for a while. And it's going to be a completely different sonic sort of thing and a completely new tempo and a completely different thing. And then kit spins around again. And now it's going to go really crazy and something completely, and then it ends and that's it, you know, and that's great. And that's really cool. That's like a symphony or something. And that's, I think, a little more typical of rock drum solos, maybe. But there's solos of Bill Bruford where I feel like he's riffing on the tune. He has a solo on Yes Songs on the tune Perpetual Change, where I feel like he's kind of playing similar to Neil. He's kind of playing the tune. Like John Bonham's solos on Moby Dick, he tended to, like, a lot of the time the tune would stop and he'd immediately go into a different tempo. But there are other versions of it where he kind of play within that original Moby Dick tempo for a while and just kind of riff based on the tune. So it could go either way. I don't know if there's a typical thing or not. But I also honestly don't listen to a lot of rock drum solos. I listen to a lot of jazz drum solos. And jazz drummers generally stay within the framework of the tune and the feeling and the sort of rhythmic motifs and rhythmic style of that tune. And I feel like in a way that YYZ solo is closer to that jazz drumming solo style than it is to a rock drumming solo style. Crazy as that sounds. But this is another way to tie it a little bit back into the jazz world.
So we talked about the evolution of Rush over the years. What about the evolution of Neil as a player? I mean, he never stopped improving, to me at least. I mean, I don't think Neil would feel this way, but are you as impressed with Neil as a player on Fly By Night as you are with him on Clockwork Angels?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of things that changed. You know, it's funny because on Fly By Night, there's some really tricky things that he's already got, you know, I mean, what, he's 22, I think, around the time they recorded that. He's already got some serious stuff, man. I mean, he's the fills, the little drum solo fills that he plays on By Tour and the Snow Dog. That stuff is no joke. That is not easy stuff to play. And that part is kind of in 7/8, and he's playing through it in a way that's, you know, just like with a lot of fluidity that's really quite advanced for anybody. And that's not easy stuff to do. I think there's a part in Beneath, Between, and Behind, the guitar solo, I think, when it goes into halftime and he's playing like an offbeat hi-hat thing. I mean, he already had some really serious stuff together, even at that stage, technically. But yeah, each record you hear some technical advancement. You hear things like, I mean, he was methodical about like coming up with ideas and then, okay, I like this idea. I'm going to figure out a way to incorporate this into a Rush song. And you hear this progression of like almost each record has some new ideas that you didn't hear in the previous record that become part of his vocabulary. But I mean, this also actually goes all the way through Snakes and Arrows and Clockwork Angels too, where he was still finding new ideas and new things to do that he was going to find a way to incorporate into the songs and just bring new ideas, new colors in. There are technical things that are just fast and intricate that he gets better and better and better, and things get sort of, he gets more and more fluid with playing faster around the kit. And in some ways, maybe Hemispheres, Permanent Waves, Moving Pictures are kind of a pinnacle of that. Like those have some of the most technically difficult things just from a pure stamina point of view and a point of view of like, okay, this is very fast. This just takes a lot of technique to be able to do, or this takes a lot of stamina to be able to do this thing for a long, long time. But then there were other things. He started getting more and more into things that were independence challenges. So again, don't know how many of you will know what independence means in regards to drum technique, but independence is basically the ability to do one thing with one limb and something completely different with the other limb, and maybe all four limbs too. You know, like your right foot is doing something, your left foot is doing something completely different, your right hand is doing a third thing that bears no relation to the other three, and then your left hand is doing something completely different yet. So that's independence. And some of his greatest feats of independence are on the Grace Under Pressure record, actually. I think the beat that he plays in the sort of chorus section of Enemy Within, or sort of, it's not really a chorus, it's like a breakdown where Geddy plays a synth melody, those little instrumental sections that happen a few times in the tune. And that beat that he plays is fiercely difficult. The drum beat that he plays in the sort of B sections of Red Lenses is insanely difficult to play. The patterns that he plays in like Mystic Rhythms, the patterns he plays in Bravado and Scars on Presto, these are really serious feats of independence where he's doing something. I mean, these are just really challenging things to do. And I think a lot of people don't even realize, people haven't really tried these beats or tried sort of breaking down what they are. I think a lot of them don't even realize how difficult they are until you actually try to do them. Because I think for some people too, they don't realize how Neil's kit is set up, and they don't realize that like, oh, to play this drum at this point, he's doing it with this hand and it's over here. And at the same time, he's doing something completely different with his right hand, but it's way back here. And then he hits this drum and then his feet are doing this other thing. And it's just stuff like that is really, to me, quite amazing. And I think in a way harder than any of the sort of fast and technical stuff on Hemispheres and Permanent Waves, actually. And then he got into the super sort of minimal style on certain tunes on Presto, like on the title track Presto and parts of War Paint, where he's playing really simple parts, but I think challenging himself to like, okay, how simple, how much can I break this down to its bare elements? And that's a challenge too, because that takes an incredible amount of discipline to do that, especially if you're a drummer like Neil who likes to be active and likes to play a lot of stuff, to challenge yourself by saying, okay, I'm just going to do this simple thing for a long time. And it's got to be really precise because it's really exposed and it's going to have a certain impact if I do it and don't vary it. It's going to have a build to it that's going to be really intense, but it's going to take a lot of discipline to do. So yeah, I think that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think there's an incredible progression actually throughout his history. And then, yeah, again, like, you know, stuff on Test for Echo, when he changed his kit around after he started studying with Freddie Gruber, there's a whole new sort of vocabulary of drumming stuff that he comes up with around that time period that he uses on that record and on Vapor Trails. And yeah, I mean, he just continued to kind of get into stuff. And I mean, I actually, you know, I challenge anybody to figure out how to play Main Monkey Business exactly as Neil played it, you know, to play it exact, to voice everything on the exact right tom-toms and to play the electronic triggered sounds at exactly the right points and to flip the snare on and off on the snare drum, the wires, turning them on and off depending on the part of the tune you're in, and to coordinate all of that and to play it all in perfect time without speeding certain things up or slowing certain things down, and to be perfectly accurate and hit each drum dead center, which he was very good at. If you look at pictures from behind his kit, like every time you hit a drum head, it'll leave a little mark. So like you can kind of tell how precise a drummer is by how centered the marks on their drum heads tend to be. And with Neil, like they were really just kind of centered right in the middle. You didn't see a lot of stray marks off to the sides of the drums because he was very precise. I challenge anybody to play Main Monkey Business exactly like Neil did, as precisely as he did. That's not an easy part. It may sound a little bit easy, but it is not.
So you had a hand in refurbishing Neil's original kit with Rush, right? Mm-hmm. Chromey.
Yep.
So how did that come about, and what does it take to restore a drum kit?
Well, it took an owner who was willing to put the money and the time and the care into it and the love. So what had happened was I had been in touch with a gentleman named Michael Lowe, who runs neilpeartdrumsticks.com, which is an amazing website. And Michael is a drumstick collector. He has drumsticks from all sorts of drumming stars, but he is a massive Neil Peart fan. And he runs this website where it's actually great. He provides a great service because a lot of people put up fake Neil Peart autographs on eBay, and they put up fake drumsticks saying that these were used by Neil. And Michael is the go-to guy to identify whether this stuff is fake or real, because nobody has done the research like Michael has into, like, this is exactly the type of stick Neil used. I mean, Neil used the same stick model through his entire career with Rush, the ProMark Oak 747 stick. But that stick evolved pretty much every year. It kind of, the logo slightly changed and things like that. And Michael is, he knows exactly how to identify each year. And, you know, there are little markings and things that you can tell whether this was actually a stick that Neil owned or not. Because they did a certain, like, ProMark would designate them in certain ways that, you know, certain sticks that Neil got had a certain mark on them, like a certain logo or something that only Neil could have had. At least in certain years they did. So Michael knows all of that information. And I'd been in touch with him just to tell him how much I loved his website. And we were communicating, and I'd given him a couple of pairs of sticks that I played with Debbie Harry. So he had been in touch with a gentleman named Dean Bobasud, who is the guy who bought Chromey when Chromey went up for sale initially. It was around 2008, I believe. And Michael knew that besides being a huge fan of Neil, I was also really into vintage drums. And a lot of this, I mean, it comes from, like, being a jazz drummer, I'm obsessed with jazz history, and I'm obsessed with jazz drumming history, and learning about the types of drums that my favorite jazz drummers in the, you know, all the way back to the 1920s, but particularly the drummers in the 50s and 60s, Elvin Jones, Tony Williams, Max Roach, guys like this, what drums they were using, and the vintage drums and, you know, cymbals and things like that. So I've learned a lot about vintage drums, and I was also really into Ringo, and had learned a lot about Ringo's drums and what vintage drums he used. And I got really good at identifying things by sight, like, you know, seeing a picture and knowing, okay, that's a 9x13 tom. Oh, in this picture, no, that's an 8x12. I can just, there are certain visual cues that you can identify sizes and things like that. So Michael knew this about me, and he knew that I would be potentially a good guy to help them figure out, looking at old pictures of Neil playing Chromey, what kind of cymbal stands Neil was using. Because I should point out, when Chromey was given away initially in 1987, Neil gave away three of his kits in a Modern Drummer contest, Chromey being one of them. When he gave them away, it was basically only the drums and the two stands, I believe, that held the concert toms, the little drums up to his left. Those are the only stands that were included. No cymbal stands, no snare drum, no pedals, nothing like that was included. So Dean wanted to restore the kit without modifying it. He wanted to just get it back to looking the way it did when Neil played his last show on Chromey, which would have been around April of 1977. So what needed to be done, besides just kind of cleaning the drums up and, you know, getting the right heads on them and tuning and things like that, he needed to source all of that drum hardware and figure out what everything was, what Neil was using. And Michael and I did a lot of research finding photos. Michael was able to get a lot of the photos that have actually ended up on the Cygnus X1 website, a lot of those concert photos. Michael had actually sort of seen a lot of those before they were ever published. I think he was actually in touch with people who had taken photos during like the 2112 and All the World to Stage tours in 76 and 77. And we were like blowing up photos, getting high res versions and blowing them up and trying to figure out what this bit was and what this wing nut was. And, you know, all this kind of super detail. And we really kind of figured out almost everything. You know, I knew what symbols Neil was using. You know, we knew some things. I basically knew what the heads were, but we didn't really know much about the hardware. And it was a bizarre sort of mixture of stuff from different brands that he kind of pieced together over the 3 years or so that he used that kit. And Dean wanted to source everything. Like, I want to get exactly what Neil was using. So then we had to track down, for example, like a 1970s English made Premier cymbal stand and early 70s Pearl cymbal stands and all of this sort of like, you know, stuff that was pretty hard to find. And I had contacts in the vintage drum world. A lot of the stuff was sourced from Steve Maxwell's drum shop in New York City. But, you know, there were other things that we had to go to eBay for. And it was a really fun project. When the kit arrived, it actually had Neil's, most of the drum heads were Neil's actual drum heads that were on there from literally the last show that he played on that wow. kit. And they'd never been played. And Dean wanted to preserve those, but he wanted the kit to be able to be played. So we had to source drum heads that were identical to Neil's, but we didn't actually want to use Neil's because we didn't want to mark them up or damage them in any way. So Dean had kept taken the heads off and we sourced, you know, original vintage heads, but also some modern replicas. But it was a really fun project. And it was incredible to get to just sort of handle that kit. You know, because I told you about how my neighbor had given me All the World to Stage to borrow, and that the first recording of Neil that I owned was a tape of the drum solo on All the World to Stage. It wasn't the first thing I heard, but the first thing that I owned that I could listen to over and over and over again. So like thinking that, like, you know, that 12-year-old me who was listening to that drum solo on Working Man over and over, the idea that I would get to like handle this kit and restore it and eventually actually get to play it. Dean was kind enough to let me play it at his house. And, you know, it was amazing to just actually get to play that kit. It was really, really, really fun. I got really geeky too. I wanted to tune the tom-toms to the exact same notes that Neil tuned to. So I took recordings from All the World's a Stage. The best sort of isolated tom-tom notes are on Lakeside Park. So I took Lakeside Park and I actually took a sample of some of the isolated fills and like sort of isolated each drum so that I could like figure out the exact pitch, play it over and over again and figure out what the pitch was and tried to tune them to the exact same pitch that Neil was tuning to in those days. So it was a really, really fun project. And the kit, it was funny. I mean, it was in bad shape. That kit was really road worn. That was like, you know, those guys toured, as we know, they toured so hard in those days. I mean, they toured hard all the way up to the last tour, really, by touring standards. But they were like just endless one-nighters, you know, that they toured. You know, Neil used that kit from when he joined, you know, the first show was what, August 15th or something, 1974. And he stopped using the kit April of 77. And they were virtually working straight through. You know, they may have had a week off here and there a couple of times, but that was just nonstop. And they used that kit every night. And that kit got set up, played, and packed up. A lot of that time, they were an opening act on those first couple of tours. So the kit would, you know, they would have to like set it up, they play, and then a bunch of stage hands would have to quickly get everything off stage for the next guy to, you know, the next band to play. And, you know, stuff gets beaten up, it gets scratched up, it gets banged up. There were a lot of dents and scratches and things. And you just had the feeling that like every one of those scratches had a story to it. Like, you know, oh, this scratch was from when, you know, we were opening for Kiss and you know, we accidentally dropped one of Gene Simmons' bass amps on the tom-tom or something like that. You know, you just had a feeling that there were all kinds of stories like that wrapped up in this kit. So that was super fun.
Where's Chromie now?
Dean sold Chromie via an auction to a private buyer. I don't know anything about who. I know that it's owned by somebody else. Dean actually profited massively from that kit. You know, I mean, he put a lot of money into restoring that kit, but he sold it for a lot, which is great for Dean. I was very happy that he got a profit off of that, but sad that he sold it. I mean, he was very, very attached to that kit. He loved having it, but I guess he felt it was time, you know, it was time to move it on to somebody else. But I don't know who bought it. It's an anonymous buyer, as far as I know. I'm not sure if they've ever come public.
Now, you mentioned, Paul, the Drum History podcast. I think that was almost 5 hours of you going over Neil's gear. My son's drum teacher turned me onto the podcast, which is how we found you.
Oh, cool.
Shout out to Tony Good. But how did you gain such a vast knowledge of Neil's kits over the years? It's incredible how much you know.
Well, you know, again, it's one of those things where, like, I likely don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, but for some reason I can tell you what type of concert tom holder stand Neil used in 1976. You know, it's just, I have a really photographic memory for certain things. Unfortunately, not very important things, but, you know, like paying the bills on time or something like that. But yeah, something like that kind of stuff. And I'm like that too. I know about other drummers in a lot of detail. My brain is filled with, like, the drums Steve Gadd used throughout the years, the drums that Elvin Jones used throughout the years on John Coltrane recordings or whatever. Like, I just have a good memory for that stuff. I don't know why. And it's not like, I mean, I mostly just, I really want to be a drummer. I just like being a drummer and playing music with people and trying to make the music work for everybody. And I love teaching students how to play drums and how to be better jazz musicians and things like that. But for some reason, it's not particularly useful, but my head is just filled with this kind of stuff. You know, but it does come a lot too from reading. Long before the internet, I had all of the tour books. I had all of the Modern Drummer interviews. I had, you know, other sources like that where Neil was talking about the drums that he used and always collecting photos and things like that, and collecting, like, you know, if I would see some random magazine, like Musician Magazine used to exist. And sometimes there's like a couple of interviews with Rush or with Neil in Musician Magazine where he may have, there's like a one sentence tidbit about, like, oh, I use this on this tune or something. And it just stuck up in my head for whatever reason. So it's from a lot of sources. You know, seeing them too. I mean, I saw them a lot, and seeing the kit and studying it and, you know, going up close. You know, sometimes in arena shows after the show, like, the ushers are trying to get everybody out, but you can sometimes kind of sneak up front or to the side and kind of watch them pack up the kit. And it's like, oh, I see what that is, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of, I guess, some firsthand knowledge too. I guess that's where it comes from.
So, Paul, how do you think Neil Peart will be remembered 50, 100 years from now? Is he up there with the greatest drummers of all time, in your opinion, jazz or rock or any other genre?
I do think so, actually. Yeah. I mean, I'm never a fan when somebody refers to anybody in the music world as being like the greatest of all time or something like that. First of all, I hate the acronym GOAT, because I just think of a goat. but you know, music and art are not like sports, where sports, you know, you have statistics. You can say, like, okay, this person had more home runs than this person, so they are better, right? Like, you can quantify something. Is that the right word? You can quantify somebody or something by claiming statistics, or this person runs faster statistically. It's measured. And you just can't say that about art. You can't say that Rothko is better than Van Gogh. You know, you just can't, it doesn't work that way. And I think music and drummers are the same way. I mean, you could say somebody is one of the greatest, but, you know, you can't really say, like, oh, so-and-so is better than so-and-so, because it doesn't work that way. But I mean, I'm already seeing, like I said, I met this kid who's maybe 14 or 15, and he, you know, wasn't even really aware of drumming, probably, or not into drumming. He was alive at the same time that Rush was active, but he wasn't like me going, you know, getting the latest record and going to the shows and stuff like that. But he's still, like, Neil is a huge presence in his life, and he's very excited about him and very influenced by him. And that's a really big deal. And I think that that's already proof that this legacy of his is living on. I think that he will be remembered. Well, I hope that he's remembered as much as he's an incredible drummer technically and could play things that very few drummers can play. I hope that he will be remembered as an amazing song drummer, meaning a drummer that really cared about the song. And I think this partly being the lyric writer, obviously, he was also very concerned about the lyrics and about how the melody and the lyrics work together and how the entire mood and structure and color and timbre of a song work together and how his drum parts add to that and what he can do to influence the mood and sonic texture of a song, as well as the excitement and energy and feeling and danceability or lack of danceability, you know, whatever he wanted to go for. That's what he was into. That's why he played the stuff that he played, because he wanted to serve the song in a certain way and make the song go somewhere or do something. And I think that that was like, I think he did that at the highest imaginable level. And I hope that that's how he's remembered. I hope that people realize how much he cared about songs that he played and about the music that he played. He was also a huge music fan. And I really realized that when I read Traveling Music, when he's just talking about all these really varied records, everything from Madonna's Ray of Light to, you know, Sinatra records. You know, he just loved music and was a fan of music and a fan of songs and a fan of great songwriters, as well as great players and great drummers. So I hope that that's part of his legacy, besides all the stuff I was talking about, oh, La Via Strangiato is very hard to play, or his independence on Red Lenses is incredible. And that's all great. And that's important. And that's him, you know, upping the ante and setting a high standard for himself and thus all of us. But I think also, you know, his attention to song structure and caring about the way he made the songs go somewhere, I think that's hugely important too.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge of Neil Peart with us today. And thanks for joining us on the Rush Fancast. We appreciate it.
I'm so glad to. Thank you so much, guys, for having me on. It's an honor to be on the podcast. So thank you.
I don't know about you, Jer, but I feel like I just attended a lecture at Juilliard. What a masterclass in all things Rush and Neil Peart.
I know. It just encyclopedic is all I kept on thinking of when we were talking to him. He just knows so much. And I guess because he's a professor and is used to imparting wisdom, it was just great listening to him.
Yeah, and I learned so much about the drums and about music. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, it was so much fun talking to him.
And he could have gone much more in depth too. And if you want to hear more from Paul discussing Neil's kits in detail, you can find him on the Drum History Podcast. And this is what I listened to before we had him on, Jared. 3 episodes and more than 3 hours of Paul talking about Neil's drum kits and Neil's drumming. Really is an incredible thing.
It is. Everyone should go listen to it right now. Right now. Well, maybe when they're done with this episode, go listen to it.
And also thanks to Tony Good, who is my son's drum teacher. He suggested we speak to Paul. And what a great suggestion.
Yeah, a great suggestion. We should get more suggestions from him.
We should.
Mr. Good.
Tony Good is very good. And next week, Jer, I'm going to do a little tease. We haven't done a tease since we know who our guest is going to be next week. I'm going to do a tease.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Just go ahead. Tease away.
It's a previous guest we've had on, a magical voice from across the pond. What do you think of that?
Wow, that's a very interesting way to say it.
The fall season continues. We'll say that too. You can find us on Twitter or X at Rush Fancast. Instagram, find us at The Rushcast. Email Jerry, let him know what you thought of our interview with Paul Wells at therushcast@gmail.com. Lex did the bass intro and outro. Jared, hope you have an email to finish us off.
I do, and it's from half the world.
Oh, nice.
Half the world lies, half the world learns, half the world flies as half the world turns. Half the world cries, half the world laughs, half the world tries to be the other half.
I'm always trying to be your half, Jared. Can never quite get there. Thanks, Jer. Have a good week.
All right. See you later.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.